Okay, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be here. And yes, I'm going to talk today about something that I find quite troubling about the right of self-determination. If you look at the literature, and indeed cases like resecession of Quebec, some of the separate opinions in the recent Wall opinion by Judge Cancada and Tridade and Judge Youssef, if you look at the Commission on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination's general recommendation, and indeed much of the academic literature, you will see this distinction made between internal aspects of self-determination and external aspects of self-determination. And the question that I wonder is why? Why is this distinction made? And partly, I put up a few sort of ideas. Partly it's to do with structuring ambiguity. Peoples in self-determination are undefined. There is supposed to be no definition of the concept. The content of self-determination is, by definition, self-determined. It has no independent content specifically, although, of course, there have been a number of attempts to pin it down in certain areas. But I think what's also interesting, and which has emerged in the last couple of years, alongside the fact that there's a sort of general long-standing ambiguity behind self-determination, yes, it's got no definition, yes, the right can mean this and that, is some of the practice that's come out of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. A case, Kevin Mwanga Gunmen, Cameroon, of 2009. The African Commission, which for a long time tiptoed around the idea of peoples in Africa. I mean, it said, yes, peoples in Africa have all these rights, but it just tiptoed around the idea of what these peoples were. Then in recent practice, it actually has been really quite ready to identify these peoples. So in Kevin Mwanga Gunmen, it identified a southern Cameroonian people based on language, politics, and territory. What it did with its self-determination is a little bit confusing, but nonetheless, it identified a people within an African state. In COVRE, which is an acronym for housing rights, something or other, versus Sudan, it identified a racially based Darfurian people. And more than that, it considered that this people was subject to the domination of another people within a state. So this issue of internal and external self-determination, on one hand, it's a sort of question of how we deal with the ambiguities of self-determination, but also another context which I'm very well aware of is actually a recent practice where peoples within states are actually being identified. So the question is, why divide self-determination in this way? I mean, of course, it's very handy considering that there is no definition of people, that there is no specific content of the right, because we have these wonderful ambiguities. It's very tempting to find ways to divide it to make it more specific. So why divide it in this way? There are other ways in which you could divide self-determination. You could divide it in terms of its rights. The Article 1 of the Human Rights Covenants provides that self-determination has political, economic, social, and cultural aspects. You could divide it up. You could have a fourfold division of self-determination in terms of rights. You could divide it in terms of potentially its subjects. There's, of course, colonial people, peoples under alien domination, occupation. A distinction that was recently made in the Kosovo opinion by the International Court of Justice, where they said there is in terms of positive rights, then we're looking at peoples, non-self-governing territories, and peoples subjected to alien subjugation, domination, exploitation. You could perhaps divide it up according to political theory, look at its nationalist elements, perhaps Marxist elements, liberal elements, and so on and so forth. But the overwhelmingly popular method of dividing up self-determination is according to its dimensions, its purported dimensions. That self-determination somehow has an internal aspect and an external aspect. Oops. Now, this division is not has a reason for it. There are good reasons why you might want to adopt this distinction. on one hand, the subject, peoples, are a significant part of group identity, of national group identity, is this notion of borders, and indeed, of course, there's a whole area of study based around national groups as defined by their borders, this notion of otherness, ethnic groups and their boundaries, and so on and so forth. So this idea of who is external, who is internal to a people, is often an important element in how peoples define themselves. This notion of group borders, who's on one side of the border, who's on the other. So the subject of self-determination in itself could have inherent internal and external elements. The elements in the right, self-determination typically relates to self-government. Self-governing units typically have internal and external aspects according to principles of jurisdiction, the issues of where a state's authority extends. If you're within a state's jurisdiction, you could be considered internal to its system of self-government. If you are outside it, then you could be considered external to it. And following from that, of course, states as self-governing units have internal and external aspects, and broadly speaking, that separates domestic law from international law. The issues which come within a state's domestic legislative sphere could be considered to be part of its internal aspects, and its external relations could be considered to be its external aspects, or external, internal, and external aspects of sovereignty. So there are a number of aspects of self-determination where we can actually say, yes, okay, there are internal and external aspects in all these particular elements. So what does that mean then when we translate that into the actual right? I think you can look at four units in relation to internal and external self-determination. Peoples, sovereign states, political units within states, and political units as distinct from states, or distinct from states in some form. And what we can see is that in each of these units, what is internal and external in self-determination takes on a different character. The first of these units would then be the people. This would be the most obvious way in which you'd measure self-determination. That self-determination relates to the internal aspects of that people or the external aspects of that people. And if we look at the instruments on self-determination which suggest such a distinction, in particular Principle 8 of the Helsinki Final Act, and Article 4 of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the suggestion is that self-determination is measured by the boundaries of the people themselves. So, under the Helsinki Final Act, by virtue of the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples, all peoples always have a right, in full freedom, to determine, when and as they wish, their internal and external political status, without external interference. In the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples, Indigenous peoples, in exercising their right to self-determination, have the right to autonomy or self-government in matters relating to their internal or local affairs. The suggestion is, in both of those instruments, that the boundary for measuring internal and external self-determination is the dimensions of the people themselves. Now, if we plot this out in a little sort of diagram, we sort of visualise these boundaries, this works very well where the people, which I've represented in green, corresponds with a state. So if the people happily corresponds with a state, then what is internal for the people that state's self-government is internal self-determination for the people, and that state's relations with other states relates to that state's external self-determination. And arguably, especially when we look at the Helsinki Final Act, that's pretty much what they had in mind. If you look at the debates surrounding the Helsinki Final Act, the focus on self-determination is on states in Eastern Europe, states behind the Iron Curtain who don't enjoy full self-government because of Soviet domination. And it's the feeling that the peoples of those states, the peoples of Poland, the peoples of Hungary, have a right to external self-determination and internal self-determination to loosen the grip of the Soviet rule. On the other hand, if we base self-determination around a people, and the people this time is a minority within a state, and we apply the same dimensions, what is internal self-determination would be self-determination, simply self-rule within that particular people, within that particular area. The external self-determination of that people could be relations with the rest of the world, but it could also be relations with the rest of the state. If we use the people as the basis for internal and external self-determination, then external self-determination could also be exercised within a state, if we use the people as the basis for this division. The second unit would be to base what is internal and external around the state. So here's the people, a minority within a state, and what is internal is basically defined by the borders of the state. So self-government within the state, that's internal. The external relations of that state, that is external. It is then basically the state, or rather state sovereignty, that defines what is internal and external. In essence, internal and external self-determination in this context is self-determination in accordance with the internal or external aspects of state sovereignty. And we can see quite a correlation between the typical content that's associated with internal self-determination and the constitutional values that are associated with sovereignty. So, under this interpretation of self-determination, we can see that internal self-determination says that authority comes from the people. Well, constitutions often say exactly the same thing. Internal self-determination is typically associated with the protection of human rights. Well, human rights are typically found in constitutions. Internal self-determination is also often associated with constitutional rule, rule of law. Similar values are found in constitutions and democratic governance. Similarly, something closely associated with internal self-determination, also something spelled out in constitutions. So the connection between, in the case of self-determination based around a state, what internal self-determination is basically is largely the internal aspects of sovereignty and the constitutions of states which uphold those ideas. Now, when we look at the interpretations of internal and external self-determination, this is a very popular interpretation of this distinction. This is the interpretation adopted by the Canadian Supreme Court in recent session of Quebec, a people's pursuit of its economic, social and cultural development within the framework of an existing state. And of course, the Canadian court considered that this was the normal way in which states achieve self-determination. Self-determination of a people is normally fulfilled through internal self-determination. A right to external self-determination arises only in the most extreme of cases. So the Canadian court's decision is significant in the first of all, it defines internal and external self-determination around the state, but it also says that the normal way of exercising self-determination is internally. Now, of course, if we measure self-determination by state sovereignty, then, of course, one of the major themes of international law has been the idea that this hard shell of state sovereignty with its sort of crisp internal and external aspects has been steadily eroded by human rights provisions and also by self-determination. So that the idea of sovereignty being some sort of clear barrier which organisations like the United Nations should respect and steer clear of, that's been progressively eroded, and that's of course been one of the big themes of international law over the past several decades. And a similar point can then be made if you interpret self-determination according to the boundaries of a state. So one of the criticisms that was made of internal and external self-determination during the drafting of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples by Indigenous NGOs, a lot of states' representatives who were very keen on the idea of Indigenous peoples having internal self-determination, the Indigenous groups themselves were much less keen, and they poked holes in this distinction. One of them was one of the arguments they made is that, well, as Indigenous representatives, we're participating in this external international activity of drafting this instrument, isn't this actually external self-determination for us? That we're actually, you know, not with our peoples, but we're away at an international conference dealing with an instrument which is potentially significant, has potential significance for international law. So we're actually engaged in external self-determination. That was the argument they made to try and break down this distinction. And it's a fair point, because if you base self-determination around state sovereignty, then that sort of hard shell of state sovereignty has been eroded by exactly this sort of international human rights work. Another thing to note also, just while we're looking at states, because this is the most popular sort of interpretation of this internal and external division, is the ideology behind these two different strands of the right, so the internal and external aspects of the right. Internal self-determination has often been associated as a right of democracy, as a right to as a sort of collective right to human rights, as a right to constitutional rule within a state. It's been very strongly associated more with the liberal aspect. If we could see self-determination as existing within a sort of liberal nationalist framework, internal seems to emphasise more the liberal aspects of self-determination. Or at least a lot in the literature, that seems to be often the way that the academics tend to use internal way self-determination as a way of promoting democratic rights or human rights. It's interesting, though, when you look at actually how states use internal and external self-determination. So, for example, I collected a sort of sample of states who have quite readily adopted the idea of an internal and external distinction. So the Soviet Union, before the Human Rights Committee, argued that people within the Soviet Union enjoyed internal self-determination. In the recent submissions on the Kosovo advisory opinion, internal self-determination was readily adopted by countries like Iran, Belarus, Egypt, Jordan, Azerbaijan, Venezuela, countries which don't necessarily have a particularly liberal political frame of mind. So internal self-determination is often touted as this sort of right to liberal democracy. But what we see, in fact, is that it's quite adaptable, and that governments with a rather less liberal tradition have equally adopted it and run with it. They've not been afraid of it. They've adopted it and adjusted it to their own particular political frameworks. Also, if we sort of make this distinction that internal and external, internal tends to relate to individual rights, to liberalism, external to independence, to nationalism, there's also then this issue of remedial secession. Remedial secession, basically the idea that states that violate human rights then lose their right to sovereignty, a very liberal idea. So the distinction between these are not clear cut. Equally, with internal self-determination, you can have a situation where internal self-determination is used to establish autonomies, which are used to promote nationalist movements. Nationalist movements can flourish very well within autonomous government and use it as a way to promote their political views, as indeed is happening in Scotland right now. So the second and most popular way of interpreting this internal-external division is in relation to the state. But as we can see, it's not entirely unproblematic. A third possibility is that you might have a distinct political unit within a state. So in this case, the people has its own self-governing unit. What goes on within that self-governing unit is internal. What happens outside that self-governing unit is external. This again is implied very much by the language of the Declaration on Indigenous Peoples. But I think if you look at the comments that are made in the drafting, it's very much still focused, when they talk about this distinction, it's very much focused on states, even though that is implied by the language, that it is internal within their own sort of systems of self-government. One possibility, though, where this may become significant is in the case of a breakup of a state, where administrative boundaries are in the process of hardening into international boundaries, for example, under the doctrine Vultus Possidetis, then what was internal and external could then become more significant internationally. So Macedonia, I chose Macedonia simply because it's easy to fit in, I think, on this map, but we could say that Macedonia, with the breakup of Yugoslavia, what was going on internally and externally within the Macedonian Republic in Yugoslavia then becomes significant internationally. So after, with the breakup of Yugoslavia, the action of Utipossidates around the borders of the Macedonian Republic, self-governing unit within Yugoslavia, then define what is internal and external. So in some circumstances, although this is not a widely used interpretation, in certain circumstances we could actually see this also applying. The fourth unit is in some ways one of the most significant. And this is political units distinct from a sovereign state. So we could think of units that are in some level, some legal level, distinct from the state. So we can't say that they're really internal to a state. They could be a non-self-governing territory on the other side of the world. They could be a freely associated territory. They could be an occupied territory, or they could be under some form of territorial administration. But they enjoy a legal status that is distinct from the state in some form or other. Now, what does internal and external mean in these contexts? Often it can mean a limitation on the rights of those entities. And an example of this is a statement made by Israel before the Human Rights Committee relating to the occupied Palestinian territories. Internal self-determination has already been practiced by Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well as those living in Jerusalem. Having taken part in democratic elections under international supervision, as a result, they had their own freely elected administration, governing all spheres of civil life with no interference by Israel. So quite an extensive description of Palestinian internal self-determination. When it comes to external self-determination, Israel's comment is that it is taking place through a political process agreed to by the Palestinians. Now, this was in the context, this was some time ago in the context of the Oslo Accord. So this is the context in which Israel is commenting. But we can see that Israel is much happier to talk about internal self-determination than external. And when you make this division, there is a trade-off. And it's very obvious when it's focused around states, the reason why we make this distinction and why the normal method of self-determination is internal self-determination is you want to prevent secession. So in a sense, there's a little bit of divide and rule going on. Divide up self-determination and the softer, less threatening internal version is heavily promoted, and the more difficult external version is shoved to one side. So in this context, we can see perhaps this taking place, that Israel is happy to talk about internal self-determination for Palestinians, but rather more cagey on what external might mean. And this takes us back to potentially the origins of this distinction. I've been looking to see where this distinction has come from, and the earliest I can trace it back is just after the Second World War, in the context of the Indonesian independence struggle. Now, you have in Indonesia at the time the Dutch, whose power had recently been shaken, of course, by the Japanese occupation. They were trying to re-establish their rule, but quite weak. Challenging them were the Indonesian Republicans, who wanted a unitary Indonesia. But alongside the Indonesian nationalists, who wanted a sort of a strong centralized Indonesia, were traditional rulers who weren't that chummy with the Dutch, but they were suspicious of the new nationalists. They had their own traditional spheres of influence, and they were quite happy to maintain those traditional sort of political areas of authority. Now, during the process of the struggle, there were a number of conferences, and in 1949 there was a UN round table conference which brought together the Netherlands, the Republicans and the Federalists, who were the traditional leaders who were more inclined to the Dutch and perhaps a little bit sceptical or wary of the Republicans. And negotiations at the time centred on a federal Indonesian state, which was then in a loose union with the Netherlands. So the Dutch had some influence. There was talk about a fairly loose union within Indonesia. Now, as part of this negotiating tactic, the Netherlands promoted the idea that self-determination for Indonesia had two elements. That it had an internal element and an external element. And for internal self-determination, that was the right of different populations in Indonesia to determine their position within the federation. So it was something that was basically aimed against the Republicans to strengthen the hand of the Federalists, that they could perhaps assert their independence more against a centralized Indonesia. External self-determination, according to the Dutch, was the right of populations to disassociate their respective territories from the United States of Indonesia, and possibly then form a separate, closer union with the Netherlands. Very much in the same way that, of course, the Netherlands then divided off West Papua and kept it under their control for a longer period. So we can see the Netherlands coining of this distinction and their use of this distinction as very much a sort of colonial divide and rule tactic. Separate the Federalists from the Republicans and also hold out the offer for them. If you don't really want to be in with the Republicans, maybe you'd rather separate from Indonesia and continue an association with us. So it's very much a sort of colonial divide and rule tactic. But the use of this internal division is to weaken self-determination, to drive wedges within the Indonesian population and lessen the impact of their claim for self-determination overall. Now this is significant then because within the context, within the colonial context, internal and external self-determination was actually used to undermine the colonial rights. And when discussions began on the human rights covenants on Article 1 of self-determination, which is of course seen very much as the standard for the right in international law, internal and external divisions were made, in particular by the Dutch, and they were made as an argument why Article 1 shouldn't be included in the covenant. They were made as an internal and external self-determination was made as an argument against a legal right to self-determination. And indeed, some of the proponents of Article 1 got very annoyed with this, and Greece, one advocate, dismissed these objections as hair-splitting and tried to make the right of self-determination seem unnecessarily complicated. But this context is quite significant. The internal and external self-determination in the colonial context, by dividing it, by weakening it, was something that was adopted by colonial powers to lessen the impact of self-determination. And that's not particularly different from the way it's used by states. You divide self-determination in order to weaken it, to negate its secessionist potential. So one of the significant things, perhaps, when the Canadian court spoke about self-determination normally being exercised internally, and it listed a number of peoples who were entitled to external self-determination. So colonial peoples were entitled to right of external self-determination because they denied the ability to internally exercise their right of self-determination. And that was very much the argument that they made, that the reason why some groups, colonial peoples, have this right of external self-determination is that the colonial powers have denied, or the occupying powers in cases of occupation, have denied their internal self-determination. And this was very crucial to the Canadian court's thinking. So it makes this distinction, but the thinking in the background, and the which they also sort of say, is that for the Canadian court, the colonial right is now undisputed. They can talk about the denial of internal self-determination leading to a right of external self-determination for alien subjugation, because there's no question anymore about the existence of a colonial right. The original use of internal and external self-determination to weaken a colonial right has now passed into history, has now been forgotten. But that's a sort of crucial thing, that where self-determination is in doubt, this division is used as a method of weakening it. So there is an irony in the Canadian court saying that people are entitled to external self-determination because they've been denied internal self-determination, because that division is also used in cases of foreign occupation to weaken the right of self-determination overall. And this undermines perhaps the idea that internal and external self-determination functions as a common denominator in self-determination. The simple argument that, yes, people have rights to external self-determination because they've been denied internal self-determination perhaps obscures the possibility that the distinction itself is a way of weakening those rights. So I'll sort of sum up and then leave a sort of couple of thoughts about which I'm struggling with myself as to sort of how to view this. First of all, what can we conclude about internal and external aspects of self-determination? Firstly, they aren't simply something that is artificial and made up. They are inherent in a number of aspects of the right of self-determination in terms of its subject, in terms of what the right might involve, and in terms of the objects that are claimed by the right. Internal and external aspects, however, take different forms. What is internal and external takes different forms in different contexts. There is a difference between if you use the state as the measure of what is internal and external, or the people, or political units, whether inside or outside the state, and that has different significant consequences. There is a general interpretation, which seems quite prevalent, in the Canadian court in particular, that self-determination is basically self-determination measured according to the internal and external aspects of state sovereignty. That seems to be the most popular. But there's no reason why that has to be the preferred definition. It's preferred because it's quite handy if you want to prevent secession or you want to discourage secession. There is no underlying theoretical or conceptual difference between internal and external aspects of self-determination. There is no particular philosophy that divides self-determination in that way. You can say, perhaps, that internal gives more emphasis to liberal aspects of self-determination, perhaps external to more to the nationalist aspects of self-determination, but there's no clear-cut distinction. It's a much more complicated picture. Nationalism features in internal self-determination, liberalism features in external self-determination. Now, if we return to this issue of state-based internal and external division, and we say that actually it doesn't have to be this way, why is this the most popular way, and what problems does this distinction cause? The state-based internal and external division is intended to reduce the legitimacy of secession. But at the cost that it does so is by introducing a very sharp dichotomy between internal self-determination, which is presented as normal, that's the normal method of self-determination, and the external, which is normally prohibited. Why that should be, apart from the fact that it's obviously in the interest of states that it should be so, is not so clear. And you have to, and there is always this problem of trying to justify why are peoples entitled to one branch of self-determination, but then automatically excluded from the other. Within this distinction, there's also the possibility of a transition from one form to another, that internal self-determination could, in certain circumstances, turn into external self-determination. In a state-based division, the rationale for that is state-based. The reason why internal self-determination becomes external self-determination is measured according to the behaviour of the state. If the state is engaged in massive human rights violations against the people, then that is at least in some theories, considered to trigger this transition from an internal right to an external right. But it is not based on necessarily what the people do, but it's based on what the state does. On the other hand, if we measure it around the state, what is internal and external around the borders of a state, that language does at least support the idea of a state as a community. We can say, oh, there may be a people within the state, but there are other peoples, and we're all a happy family internally exercising our self-determination within the borders of a state. So this is what we could say about state-based self-determination. It introduces this rather sharp and in some ways difficult to explain dichotomy between the right, but you have one area of the right that's good, one area of the right that's kind of suspect. If we float an alternative that we would actually measure self-determination by the dimensions of the people, that would actually diffuse the tension within the distinction. If a people exercises within a state, exercises rights internally within its own territory and externally in relation to other units within the state, in relation to the state's institutions, its relations between the state's institutions then become part of its sort of external self-determination. It actually diffuses this rather tense distinction between internal and external aspects. External self-determination doesn't have to be secession. External self-determination could be exercised day to day within a state simply as an expression of the interaction between that people within the state and the state institutions. So external self-determination could be the enjoyment of human rights within a state. If all the people, all the individuals within that people are enjoying their human rights before state organs, you could also argue that they could be enjoying external self-determination. Alternatively, where you have a very repressive, discriminatory state, then, and secession then seems to be the option, that also would come within the concept of external self-determination. But you might make the argument that it would actually take, that there is a relationship between a people and its state governed by external self-determination, and that relationship would only change in very extreme circumstances, and you could then justify it in extreme circumstances. So both internal and external self-determination could be freely exercised, and there wouldn't be an inherent tension between the two. You wouldn't have to say that internal self-determination is normal and external is normally prohibited. External as secession, you could say, is normally prohibited, is the extreme situation. But then that's more sort of justifiable. In the case of remedial secession, as I said, you could say that the external aspects of self-determination relate to the relationship between the state and its people, and that changed relationship might then justify remedial secession. So could this then diffuse one of the problems with internal and external self-determination, that you have one right that's good and one right that's dodgy? The only disadvantage that I can see with it, and it is potentially a disadvantage, is the language that it uses. If you interpret self-determination, the internal and external division, in this way, then basically what you're doing is taking language that is normally associated with interstate relations and bringing it in within the state. When we think about a state external relations, and when we talk about external relations, we usually think of international relations. Now you'd be actually using that similar sort of language within a state. It might also support the idea of alien domination within a state. Although, interestingly then, that's something that the African Commission has recognised could exist. The African Commission has taken strides in the Kore and Sudan case of actually conceptualising that, yes, you can have peoples dominating one another within a state. And it also supports one consequence of thinking of the distinction this way, is that you think of peoples in spatial and political terms. That if a people has to have dimensions, political, territorial dimensions, then you have to root it to a particular territory, to a particular political status. There have to be representatives to represent the people against the external organs. So if you looked at internal and external self-determination this way, it would have the advantage of diffusing a lot of the problems with that distinction. The disadvantage is linguistic, basically, that it introduces language which is perhaps rather uncomfortable into the relations between peoples and their states. So those are sort of issues I'm sort of thinking about at the moment in relation to this distinction. And I'd be very, very happy to hear your ideas and what you think, what I've been talking about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.